The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We had another power outage, like the one we had a few weeks back. We were just getting into the program today, talking about some very encouraging stats. 6 baptisms since we moved into Edstone in November of last year. Today we had yet another one from a member supporting us down in the London area. And I want to read to you. I'll read to you again if you heard the top of the program a few minutes ago. But this email response that came in from a member supporting us in the state of Oregon, there in the northwest of the United States. He said the programs are powerful. He's been attending 7 months now. He enjoys the spiritual food, it says, all the programs that further educate me, as he says, in God's true way of life. I have a child on the way. And yesterday's program, Teach Your Children About God, couldn't have come at a better time. He said he'd pray for the Mystery of the Ages mark, the 2000 goal that we've set, and commented that hopefully this will hasten along the return of Jesus Christ. So all of this represents growth. In terms of full-fledged membership, it's slower going. With a baptism here and there, new people attending, in congregations scattered over all the earth. But it is growth nonetheless, much needed growth. Whether it's here in the UK or in Oregon, anywhere on this earth, God's given us such an important work to do. Speaking of that MOA or Mystery of the Ages goal, there's another offer coming up on TV in the UK. Just this weekend, something to be praying for sure. On today's program, I'd like to discuss an important history lesson coming from Professor Victor Davis Hanson. I'm going to focus in on one of his columns, his recent articles, which really does give, a powerful overview of so many things that are happening in the world today. We'll talk to, if we have time, we're going to be a little bit shorter on time with this particular episode, but if we have time, we'll talk also about just how common it is for, even as the world burns, for people to be at ease in Zion, as the Bible says. Even as the world burns, for people to tune out God's warning message, to go to sleep. To slumber. I'd like to start with respect to news. I'd like to start with Jerusalem. Jerusalem is like the thermometer for world events. Brad McDonald has talked about this before using this analogy. If Jerusalem heats up, then you can be sure that the world will heat up as well. Bible prophecy says that events in the latter days are going to revolve around the city of Jerusalem, the city that God has chosen, the city that Jesus Christ will return to in just a few short years. Jerusalem is the measuring device. In watching Jerusalem, we can anticipate so many prophesied events. David Horowitz at the Times of Israel, he says this is not an uprising against occupation, what's happening in Jerusalem. He says it's an uprising against Israel. In bloody, unmistakable capital letters, the perpetrators of this new round of evil, mayhem, proclaim to Israelis, we don't want to live alongside you, we want to kill you. That's what they're spelling out, these terrorists, in bloody, unmistakable capital letters. They want to kill Jews. We talked last week about why there's so much hatred, intense hatred, for Jews in the world today. Not just in Jerusalem, all over the earth. But it's especially intense right now in and around Jerusalem. Horovitz says, they say this is not organized or orchestrated terrorism, but it is. In fact, it is more widely orchestrated than the suicide bombings of the Second Intifada. There is organization and structure here. This is not random, what's happening on the streets of Jerusalem. It's organized. It's calculated. It says, at the start of the 2000s, Hamas and Fatah terrorists were training, arming, and dispatching suicide bombers to target our buses, malls, restaurants, and more, killing 10 and 20 and 30 people at a time. What we face now is unknown numbers of potential attackers who've been stirred to murderous fervor by a thoroughly organized campaign of hatred against us. Israel hasn't seen anything like this before. The unknown numbers of potential attackers. The fence and added security that they built around Jerusalem to separate it from the West Bank. That went a long way toward curbing some of those attacks from the early 2000s. The bombings, the suicide missions on malls, buses, and so on. But how do you slow this down when the attackers are living in the same neighborhoods in some cases, shopping at the same malls? It says it was the case 11 to 15 years ago, or as was the case 11 to 15 years ago, the result is that we see, set out each day. Well, we lost power once again, but the at least lights. I'll turn on my flashlight here. There we go. Someone must be working extra hard upstairs. In any event, hopefully the stream continues. And this is carrying on to our headquarters facility in Edmond, Oklahoma. But coming back to this article by David Horovitz, he says, as was the case 11 to 15 years ago, the result is that we set out each day knowing that people around us want to kill us. For now, they are generally using less devastating methods than back then, but potentially there are more of them. And they are right here among us, on the good side of the barrier we built to stop those Second Intifada bombers. They are men, women, and even children. And the brainwashing has been so effective that they come at us ready and willing to die in the act of killing a Jew. The evil Jew. They've been so effectively persuaded, who has no right to be here, who has no connection to Jerusalem and to this land. That's what they're being taught. Not just by the Palestinian Authority. That's what they're being taught by reputable sources in the mainstream major media. Even the New York Times calling this into question, whether or not the Jews have the right to live there. Whether or not the Jews even have a connection to Jerusalem. That spirit of hatred and division is strong in this world. Horovitz says, they say that this is the latest uprising against the occupation. It isn't. It's the latest uprising against Israel. That's what this is against. And they've been, the leaders in among the Palestinians have been stirring this up for months, for years now. He says here, most Israelis don't want to rule over the Palestinians. Most Israelis want to separate from the Palestinians. And Israel would separate from the Palestinians if they could just get an assurance that by doing so, they wouldn't risk full-scale war. It says, much of the rest of the world so short-sighted in viewing Israel as the Goliath when it's a tiny, loathed sliver in a region seething with Islamist extremism. That's what the world refuses to see. It sees Israel as the Goliath and the Palestinian people as the little David. In fact, Goliath surrounds Israel. It says, but in bloody, unmistakable capital letters, this is what was paraphrased also in the subhead of the article, the perpetrators of this new round of evil mayhem proclaim to Israelis, we don't want to live alongside you, we want to kill you. We want to force you out of here. We want to get rid of you. Of course, the Bible prophesies, as we've covered even recently, that the city of Jerusalem is to be officially divided. Some would say it's already divided. It's already divided in terms of demographics, with mostly Palestinians living in the east and mostly Jews living in the west. But there's certainly enough overlap to make this a very dangerous and tense situation where you don't know where the next attacker is coming from, where the numbers are unknown, the number of potential attackers that have been stirred to murderous fervor, as he says in his article. This is building to the city being divided, which Zechariah 14 prophesies, and other Bible passages, of course, talk about how that this division will set the stage for the city, Jerusalem, to be taken by a conquering force. The European force, the German-led European Empire. All this, though, is triggered by the division of the city of Jerusalem. My father wrote back in 2006, when half of Jerusalem falls, it starts a chain reaction of events, an avalanche of crises that leads directly to Christ's second coming. And so that's why we watch. Jerusalem is the thermometer. Jerusalem is the measuring stick. It really does show us just how close we're getting to the return of Jesus Christ. It says here in this piece by Victor Davis Hanson, in the current epidemic of Palestinian violence, scores of Arab youths are attacking, supposedly spontaneously, Israeli citizens with knives. Apparently, edged weapons have more Quranic authority, and in the sense of media spectacle, they provide greater splashes of blood. Thus, the attacker is regularly described as unarmed, quote-unquote, and a victim when he is, quote, disproportionately stopped by bullets. That's how they're described oftentimes in major media reports. The Obama State Department has condemned the use of excessive Israeli force in response to Palestinian terrorism. John Kirby, the hapless State Department spokesman, blamed both sides for terrorism. And the president himself called on attackers and their victims to tamp down the violence. We used some of these same quotes last week. Hanson says here, in short, the present U.S. government, which is subsidizing the Palestinians to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars every year, is incapable of distinguishing those who employ terrorist violence from the victims against whom the terrorism is directed. That's from Victor Davis Hanson. That first one, by the way, I read to you from David Horowitz from the Times of Israel. But it's Hanson here who's talking about this epidemic of violence, the splashes of blood, and then when Israel stops, or rather intervenes, to put a stop to it, the Western media will oftentimes turn on Israel and make Israel out to be the aggressor. I mean, it used to be, and this wasn't that long ago, when it was just basic foreign policy 101, really, for so many of the leaders, the diplomats in America, the United States, and Britain. This alliance with Israel was so strong. And when terrorists went and killed Jews, there was no doubting There was no doubting who is behind the evil. And there was no doubting how you went about confronting the evil. President John F. Kennedy, he once told Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir that the United States had a special relationship with Israel in the Middle East, comparable only to what it had with Britain. This special alliance between these three, these brother nations, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah, if you look at their biblical identity. But look, all you have to do is walk through Washington, D.C., to see just how strong the tie is, how strong this alliance was, and what it was rooted in. There's a bronze statue of Moses holding the Ten Commandments in the Library of Congress. The Supreme Court has a similar statue or carving, Moses with the Ten Commandments. On Capitol Hill, you can see a statue, too, of Moses holding the Ten Commandments, and it's basically filling a center spot among three statues of famous law figures right there in the House of Representatives. What a different world we are in today when we're seeing this precipitous decline in world power in the United States. It's already happened in Britain. The sun has set on the empire. And now this unraveling relationship between these three brother nations. That break in the brotherhood is prophesied. It's talked about in Zechariah 11 and verse 14. We've written about it so many times before. Isaiah 2, or rather Isaiah also, he describes this dramatic break in this brotherly alliance. Right in the latter days when you'd have a Manasseh devouring Ephraim, it says. This is Isaiah 9 and verse 21. And Ephraim devouring Manasseh, and they together fighting against Judah. If you want to understand why this relationship has been so special, why this alliance has been so strong, go and study the United States and Britain in prophecy. Go and study Herbert Armstrong's book. 6 million copies or so of that book went out to this world. Millions of people all over the earth have read that message. Coming back to this piece by Victor Davis Hanson, the title of it, by the way, is Moral Equivalence in the Middle East. Hanson says Obama's Middle East policies, well, you see the result of this decline in power. First Britain, now America, and then this unraveling alliance. And look at the Middle East today. It's in shambles, as he says here. Phony red lines, faux deadlines, reset with Putin, surrendering all the original bargaining chips in the Iranian deal, snubbing Israel, cozying up to the Muslim Brotherhood, dismissing the threat of ISIS, allowing Iraq to collapse by abruptly pulling out all American troops, giving way to serial indecision in Afghanistan, ostracizing the moderate Sunni regimes, wrecking Libya, and setting the stage for Benghazi. All of these were the result of administration choices, not fated events. These were choices. These were decisions on the part of this administration leading the United States, on the part of Great Britain. These were administrative choices. It says, one of the results of this collapse of American power, notice this, one of the results of this collapse of American power and presence in the Middle East is an emboldened Palestinian movement that has recently renounced the Oslo Accords and encouraged the offensive of edged weapons. They have been planning this. The leaders among the Palestinians have encouraged this. We wrote about it a year or so ago, earlier even, about the silent intifada. No one was talking about it. Hardly any press coverage. But it was growing in strength, this silent intifada, as the leaders were stirring it up, sensing that this is their opportunity, seeing that the relationship between the U.S. and Judah, or the U.S. and Israel, It was completely unraveling. And now they're capitalizing on this weak position. Mahmoud Abbas, it says, the subsidized president of the self-proclaimed Palestinian state and his subordinates have sanctioned the violence. Anytime Palestinians sense distance between the U.S. and Israel, they seek to widen the breach. That's just been the way. That's just been the way this is played out time and time again. Anytime they see daylight between these two, they seek to widen the breach. They use it to their advantage. Hansen says amid such a collapse of American power, Abbas has scanned the Middle East, surveyed the Obama pronouncements from his initial Arabia interview and Cairo speech to his current contextualizations and not-so-private slapdowns of Netanyahu, and has wagered that Obama likes Israel even less than his public statements might suggest. Accordingly, Abbas assumes that there might be few consequences from America if he incites another cycle of violence. There are few consequences. There are no consequences. He's inciting the violence now. And you have U.S. officials step forward to the microphone saying, look, both sides need to cool off here. Both sides need to tamp it down. No distinction is made between the attacker and the victim. That's the world we live in today. You can see why the Jews will soon turn to Germany for help, just as the Bible prophesies in Hosea 5. They're already standing alone. And without the United States and Britain, who else does Israel have? You can see why, in desperation, they turn to Europe, Germany specifically. Hansen goes from there, zooms out a little bit to give us some perspective on just wider developments or trends. He says there's a second, more general explanation for the moral equivalence and anemic response from the White House. The Obama administration is the first postmodern government in American history, and it has adopted almost all the general culture's flawed relativist assumptions about human nature. Yes, we've talked about this before too, what modern education teaches about human nature, that it's essentially good. And you see this thinking. It's deeply embedded into the thinking of the left, especially. That human nature is good, that we sit down with evil men at the negotiating table, and we can talk sense into them, and we can get them to turn it around, and we can get them to behave, we can get them to love us. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the true nature of man, which, as the Bible says, is deceitful, it's wicked, it's carnal, it's not subject to the law of God. In 1 Kings 8, it calls it a plague, the plague of the human heart. Jesus said it's a sickness that needs to be cured. It's a sickness that requires a physician. Even about ancient Israel, God said, oh, that there was such a heart in them, that they would fear me, that they would keep my commandments. Israel didn't have the heart. They didn't have the mind of God in them. Only their godly leaders had that. Those that formed the foundation of the true church. The prophets of old. But this world has been cut off from God. Satan is the god of this world. Satan has deceived the nations of this world. That's what your Bible says. But along come so many highly educated Western leaders who think that the nature in man is good and always getting better, who think that we're far beyond the tragedies, the worldwide conflagration of war. World wars are a thing of the past. This is divorced from reality, this thinking. Hansen says affluent and leisured Western culture in the 21st century assumes that it has reached a stage of psychological nirvana in which the westernized world is no longer threatened in any existential fashion, as it often was in the past. That allows Westerners to believe that they no longer have limbic brains and so are no longer bound by Neanderthal ideas like deterrence, balance of power, military alliances, and the use of force to settle disagreements. Their wealth and technology assure them that they are free, that they're free to enter a brave new world of zero culpability, zero competition, and zero hostility that will ensure perpetual tranquility and thus perpetual enjoyment of our present material bounty. Things are just on the up and up, according to the progressive mind. All of the wealth, the technology, it assures us that things are getting better, better and better. Look at what the White House spokesman said last year, in July, I think it was, about this administration improving the tranquility of the global community. And think back to what Hansen says in that previous paragraph. All the phony red lines, reaching out to the Muslim Brotherhood, dismissing ISIS, the collapse of Iraq, the collapse of Libya, Benghazi. All these choices that the administration made. We see the Middle East today on fire, burning. And yet Western leaders, many of them right in the United States, saying that things just get better and better and better. Hansen gives a listing of examples that come to his mind. Our children today play t-ball where there are no winners and losers, and thus they're schooled that competition is not just detrimental, but also can, by such training, be eliminated entirely. Our adolescents are treated according to the philosophy of zero tolerance, in which the hero who stops the punk from bullying a weaker victim is likewise suspended from school. Moral equivalence. You can't attack someone and get away with it, but you also can't attack the attacker and get away with it. Both need to be suspended. Both need to be penalized. It says, under the pretense of such smug moral superiority, our schools have abdicated the hard and ancient task of distinguishing bad behavior from good and then proceeding with the necessary rewards and punishments. There's no distinction anymore between good and bad, between good and evil. He says, our universities have junked military history, which schooled generations on how wars started, proceed, and end. We used to be taught this in schools. This is how that war started. This is who triggered it. This was the aggressor. This was the attacker. And this was the response. And here's how it ended. Not so today. As Jeremiah Jacques wrote in his piece at the Trumpet just the other day, men write history and men get it wrong. As the old saying goes, there's three sides to every story. His side, your side, and then what actually happened. What's the truth of it? What's the truth about World War II? Who was the aggressor? Who started it? You don't get discussions like this today with the current round of conflicts. There is no labeling who's right, who's wrong. No one has the courage, the conviction to stand up and speak the truth. I saw a quote just the other day about what Winston Churchill said. I think it was back in 1898 or 1899 about Islam and about how it impacts whole nations of people and what it leads to, the devastating impact that it can have. And I thought, you're not going to see anyone say or write or indicate anything along the lines of that statement, whether he said it or wrote it. I believe he wrote it. Where is the courage today? Think of Isaiah 3. Where are the leaders today who will stand up and face up to evil? It says instead, this is back to Victor Davis Hanson, instead, conflict resolution and peace studies programs proliferate, in which empathy and dialogue are supposed to contextualize the aggressor and thus persuade him to desist and seek help, as if aggression, greed, and the desire for intimidation were treatable syndromes rather than ancient evils that have remained dangerous throughout history. He says human nature is not so easily transcended just because a new therapeutic generation has confused its iPhone apps and Priuses with commensurate moral and ethical advancement. See, we look at the gadgets, we look at the technology, and we think that morally and ethically we're advancing. And that you can talk tyrants into seeking help, getting help, changing their nature, changing their behavior. God says in Hosea 4 that his people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. If we reject God's knowledge, it doesn't matter how many gadgets, how much technology we have. God says if we forget him, he forgets us. Herbert Armstrong talked about a lot of these things Mr. Hanson brings out here in this article. The paradox. Living in this time of awesome progress. Living in the midst of this knowledge explosion. And the problems of this world just get worse and worse and worse. As Mr. Armstrong said, all of this knowledge, yet virtually no happiness, just accelerating troubles, problems, evils. That's what we see. All of this knowledge and all of this evil. And man, in his vanity, thinks that there's no way there could ever be mass-scale war like there was during the 1940s, like there has been over the centuries. Even as we have some 16,000 nuclear weapons at our disposal, we are facing the threat of mass war unlike anything this world has ever seen. Look at the technology. For those that want to say that technology means we're advancing, look at what the technology has produced. Look at what man has produced with that technology. Weapons like this world has never seen. Mr. Hanson says, under the canons of the last 2,500 years of Western warfare, disproportionality was the method by which aggressors were either deterred or stopped. In other words, the aggressor goes on the rampage, and those that fight back do so if they're capable of doing so. They do it with disproportionate force. Deterrence, which alone prevented wars, was predicated on the shared assumption that starting a conflict would bring more violence down upon the aggressor than he could ever inflict on his victim. Once lost, deterrence was restored usually by disproportionate responses that led to victory over the humiliation of the aggressive party. He gives examples here. The wreckage of Berlin trumped anything inflicted by the Luftwaffe on London. The Japanese killed fewer than 3,000 Americans at Pearl Harbor. The Americans killed 30 times that number of Japanese in a single March 10, 1945 incendiary raid on Tokyo. They've sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. That was the standard philosophy, as he says here, by which aggressive powers were taught never again to start hostilities. Now look, we're just talking about the world today. in the world tomorrow. It's going to be very different. But look at how forceful Jesus Christ and the armies of God have to act at the outset of that wonderful world tomorrow, the beginning of the millennium, because of man's hardness, because of man's stubborn refusal to submit to God's rule. This has been man's way. And in this world, which is Satan's world, when aggressors, when attackers are just left to attack without anyone rising in defense to fight back, well, it leads to defeat. It leads to captivity. It leads to slavery. Hansen says the tragic but necessary resort to disproportionate force by the attacked not only taught an aggressor that he could not win the fight he had started, but also reminded him that his targeted enemy might not be completely sane and thus could be capable of any and all retaliation. In other words, it's disproportionate force that underpins any kind of effective doctrine of deterrence. If that attacker, who's going on a rampage with a knife or a machete or a meat cleaver, if he's not shot down immediately, there is no effective deterrence in place. And so think about some of the coverage. Even amid all the latest uprising of violence in the Middle East, in Israel, in Jerusalem, and the sympathy, even still, that the attackers get because they're on the side of David and the big, mean Goliath has been oppressing for these many years. It used to be just the opposite. I remember an article by Ron Fraser years ago when that alliance between the United States, Britain, and Judah, the little nation of Israel, was so strong that the U.S. and Britain, they viewed Israel, the Middle Eastern nation, as little David fighting Goliath. Today we view Israel as the Goliath, and the Palestinian attackers as David. What a change. Talk about a new world order. Hansen says unpredictability and the fear sown by the unknown also help to restore deterrence, and with it calm and peace. In contrast, predictable, proportionate responses can reassure the aggressor that he is in control of the tempo of the war that he in fact started. And worse still, the doctrine of proportionality suggests that the victim does not seek victory and resolution, but will do almost anything to return to the status quo, antebellum, which of course was disadvantageous and shaped by the constant threat of unexpected attack by its enemies. So he applies this then to the Palestinians and what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Israel. It says, under the related doctrine of moral equivalence, Westerners are either unwilling or unable to distinguish the more culpable from the more innocent. Instead, because the world more often divides by 55% to 45% rather than 99% to 1%, Westerners lack the confidence to make moral judgments. That's what we have. Again, think of Isaiah 3. Western leaders today who lack the confidence to make moral judgments. They're afraid, he says, that too many critics might question their liberal sensitivities, a charge that in the absence of dearth, hunger, and disease is considered the worst catastrophe facing an affluent Western elite. Above all, they don't want anyone questioning their liberal sensitivities. And so they lack the courage, they lack the moral courage to make moral judgments, to say this is right, this is wrong. What if that's the approach the West would have taken when fighting back against Hitler and that Nazi machine, when fighting back against the Japanese, where there has to be a moral equivalence, where there can't be a disproportionate response. It has to be even right across the board. Isaiah says, I'll give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. That's the world today. God prophesied that we would be leaderless. All the strong leaders of the past, gone, removed. Finally, it says here in Victor Davis Hanson's piece, the question is not only whether the Obama administration in private favors the cause of the radical Palestinians over a Western ally like Israel, but also whether it's even intellectually and morally capable of distinguishing a democratic state that protects human rights from a non-democratic, authoritarian, and terrorist regime that historically has hated the West, and the United States in particular, and is currently engaged in clear-cut aggression. What does it say about the state of America today, or Britain, or just among Western leaders? When the leaders, when the diplomats, when presidents, prime ministers can no longer make a sharp distinction between the attacker, the aggressor, the terrorist, and the victim, the one being attacked. As Melanie Phillips said in her book, The World Turned Upside Down, self-evident common sense appears to have been turned on its head. That's true. When people look at the world today, what a warped view so many have. With God's perspective, with God's mind, with God's spirit, however, we can see where this is headed. We can see that it's building to an explosion. And we can see just how much this world needs the rule of Jesus Christ. We can hasten along the return of Jesus Christ by pouring our hearts into this work, by pouring our support, our efforts, our energy, our prayers, our studies, our family living, making it all, as I've discussed here recently, work-oriented, work-centered, getting the children involved, teaching your children about God, committing your own life to God and His ways, being dedicated and supportive of God's work, as those few that have come out of this world and into this church and have gone through the process of repentance and faith, and of course, water baptism, which is so powerfully symbolic. Going into that watery grave, being totally buried, and then coming out a new man, a new woman, and then filled with God's Spirit, God's power, God's nature, God's love. That's the solution to all the problems and evils of this present evil world. Think ahead to that prophesied time, talked about in Isaiah 11 and so many other millennial passages, when the knowledge of God will cover this earth. They'll cover this earth. When God's educators, God's teachers, will spread around the earth and teach all of mankind, coming from every nation, coming from every religious background, about God's revealed truth, about God's knowledge. That's what this world needs. Haven't you had enough of what this world is producing? Haven't you had enough of what this world is offering to you and to your family, to your children? I know I've had enough. Jesus said, "Pray thy kingdom come." Pray for God's kingdom to come. How fervently do you pray to that end? How fervently do you pour your hearts into that section of your prayers? It's something to think about. It's something to think about as we draw near to the end of this age. We want to do everything that we can with God's help and power to hasten along the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. That is the solution. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. Our Edstone facility is right here in the beautiful Midlands of the UK. Most of the time we have power here in the radio studio. Sometimes we don't, but we work our way through it. Send us your emails, your feedback, your responses, if you like, to td@kpcg.fm. That's all that we have time for here today. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again tomorrow.